The Wyoming Game and Fish Commission approved nearly $5 million in budget cuts that were necessary after the legislature failed to approve an increase in game and fish license fees. The department is funded 80% by license fees and was already dealing with a deficit when the fee hikes were voted down. But lawmakers wanted the Game and Fish Department to be more efficient. Wyoming Public Radio's Bob Beck reports.
The cuts were approved at a recent Game and Fish Commission meeting in Saratoga, and many were unhappy.
It's our elected officials that have put the department, shall I say, in dire straits. It's going to have huge implications on our fish and wildlife resources here in the state of Wyoming.
That's Neil Thagard of the Theodore Roosevelt Conservation Partnership.
You know, we're going to see a huge reduction of more than 500,000 fish in this state that are normally part of the stocking program to some of our reservoirs for angling opportunities. Those are going to be reduced. Research, which is huge for our wildlife and fisheries, to ensure that we sustain those wildlife and fisheries resources, those monies are going to be cut.
The co-owner of the Wolf Hotel in Saratoga, Judd Campbell, is worried about the reductions to habitat programs specifically, which could result, he says, in less wildlife. And he says that would hurt his business.
Without the game and fish, without what they do and all the natural habitat that we have here, nobody's going to come to Saratoga. You know, without the river full of fish and the elk herds and the deer herds.
Some have asked the department not to go ahead with some of the cuts, but Director Scott Talbot says they had little choice. While they were initially stunned by a House committee voting down the fee hikes, after that same committee had supported the increase all summer, Talbot says they quickly got to work making up for their shortfall.
While it's been very, very painful, and it's against my values as a citizen of this state, I think that our folks should be commended for literally stepping up to the plate and really making some changes here.
He says the department will be more efficient. They froze or reduced 21 positions, and they made cuts. Habitat improvements will be reduced. But a number of residents have expressed concern that the department has decided not to spend any more money on acquiring hunting and fishing access. Talbot admits that'll be noticed.
The long-term implications of both habitat and access are staggering. If you look at the foresight that our predecessors had to acquire access on the North Platte River, the Shoshone River, the Bighorn River near Dubois, and those access areas are literally used by tens of thousands of hunters and anglers every year.
While the department has its supporters, one outdoors group has worked hard to kill the bill to increase license fees for the simple reason that they feared it would harm the hunting industry. Robert Worf is the director of Wyoming Sportsmen for Fish and Wildlife. He says increased license fees hurt some other states.
That Idaho and Montana both increased their license fees in 2009. Both those states have been having extremely difficult time selling their licenses to primarily non-resident hunters. They quit coming. There is a bar that you can't break. And we told them in 2007, when we supported the license fee increases, that we needed to be looking at other alternatives.
Worf has a list of alternatives that starts with being more efficient and reducing costs on things that he views as unnecessary, like the Wyoming Wildlife magazine. Worf also has a skeptical view of the cuts.
Some of my members have said these cuts are being made to where they're as painful as they can be, and I won't dispute that. I think in some ways it does appear as though they are cutting programs to cause pain to the people that provide their funding.
Kim Floyd is the director of the AFL-CIO and visibly shook while discussing the budget cuts. He says to harm an agency that brings in billions to the state is crazy.
It creates jobs. It keeps Main Street businesses open. That's why it just floors me that every 10 years we have to have this discussion. They have to rely on the legislature to approve any kind of a license fee increase. And about every 10 years, we go back to this, and it's something has to change.
Floyd notes that non-hunters enjoy the Wyoming outdoors, and he says they need to pay into the system. One way that could happen is by having the legislature appropriate money from the state budget for some game and fish projects. But Governor Matt Mead worries that having a non-guaranteed revenue stream could cause more problems than it would solve. The governor does stress that he's concerned about the impacts that the cuts could have, and he is considering some solutions. Game and Fish commissioners say if something doesn't change, more cuts are coming. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Bob Beck.
Governor Matt Mead is hoping to create a 10-year plan to address homelessness in Wyoming. As a first step in the process, the Department of Family Services has appointed a homelessness coordinator. Her name is Brenda Little, and she says her first task will be to identify what services are already available to homeless individuals in different communities in Wyoming.
There are folks that handle homelessness for veterans and some that handle homelessness for youth, others for folks with mental illness. And I would like to get a sense of who all those folks are and what services they provide.
Now, Governor Mead has asked for a long-term plan to deal with homelessness. What might that entail?
That's an excellent question, Willow. And I have some feelers out on that already. I know other states around the country have their 10-year plan. And I've been asking around to see if I can get a hold of those 10-year plans from some other states through some contacts I've made. I also learned that a little bit of work had been done on a 10-year plan when Governor Friedenthal was in office. So I'm also trying to track down how much was done under Governor Friedenthal's watch. And then I really want to look at what other states have done so we can get a sense of successful states and what their 10-year plans look like and what in those plans have been working. So we can model Wyoming's plan after something that's already worked.
And when you're talking about success, is the goal here to reduce homelessness or simply to provide better services to individuals who are homeless?
I think the answer to that is both, Willow. What we want to do is to make sure that the folks locally in our local communities who serve homeless people have the resources and grant funding that is available to them so that they can provide those services. At the same time, I have learned that Wyoming has a very low percentage of homeless folks that actually receive housing. And I would like to make Wyoming more successful in that area so that we can look back in a couple of years and say, we now serve homeless people better to the full extent that we are able, and that we have increased the percentage of homeless folks that have housing available or are housed at a certain period of time during the year.
Now, I'm assuming with a long-term plan that part of the goal here would be to look at what the root causes are of homelessness and address those. How might you do that? What are some of these causes? What are some things that Wyoming could be doing to help address those?
Well, those are the same questions that I am asking. And I'm in the process now of trying to learn the right questions to ask and then where to find those answers.
Stepping back for a moment, how big a problem is homelessness in Wyoming?
I think it's a bigger problem than I had realized. We have an increased number of homeless people in the last year. We have, I think, 75 to 80% more homeless folks between 2012 and 2013. A lot of that has to do with when the count is taken. Some of it has to do with the software that we use to count those folks. I actually believe that count is low from what I hear from other folks around the state and the criteria that we use to measure. I don't know yet the full extent of how big a problem homelessness is in Wyoming, but I do firmly believe that it's more of a problem than I or many of us around the state realize.
Why has there been this increase in over the last year in homelessness? I mean, is this just, you indicated that there might be issues with how things are counted, but are the numbers actually going up, do we think?
That's a good question, Willow, and that's one of the things I want to find out is how we count people. I have heard from different folks around the state that we don't necessarily count folks the way other states do. Well, should we change that? Is that something that should be done differently? Or Are we actually more accurate? I don't know the answers to those questions.
Now, obviously, there are resources in various different communities around the state for homeless people, shelters and soup kitchens and food pantries and whatnot. Why do we need a statewide plan and a statewide coordinator as opposed to sort of doing this, you know, with the local communities?
The local communities are doing very good work, and they are doing a lot of hands-on work. They are meeting with homeless folks face-to-face. They are going where homeless folks live. They are providing those services. I think what's important for the state of Wyoming to do is to help coordinate the efforts of all of those folks who are doing great work in their own communities, so that if someone in state government is able to keep track of the services that are going forth, then those services can help each other. And I can help different folks in different communities learn from each other, share resources with each other, share knowledge with each other, and also get a better sense of where we are with serving homeless folks in Wyoming.
Tell me a little bit about yourself. What is your background in working with homelessness?
My background, actually, Willow, is not in homelessness. My background is more in state administration. I've been with the Department of Family Services for 12 years. So my experience is more in coordinating efforts and administering programs than it is with homelessness, which I think is great for two reasons. First of all, I think there are other folks around the state who are very good and experts at homelessness. So I really don't need to be, because there are folks in our communities that have that expertise and that knowledge. And so I think where I can help the most is actually in my background as an administrator.
Well, Brenda, thank you so much.
Thank you, Willow. I enjoyed it a lot.
Brenda Little is Wyoming's new homelessness coordinator.
When we come back, we'll hear about a field course that's meant to teach students about geographic, historical, and religious significances of Heart Mountain in northern Wyoming. This is Open Spaces. Welcome to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Willow Belden. This month, the University of Wyoming will host a field course where students will explore the geographic, historical, and religious significances of Heart Mountain in northern Wyoming. Two educators will split teaching of the course, one focusing on history and the other on religion. The latter, Mary Keller, is a historian of religions and a lecturer at UW. She spoke with Wyoming Public Radio's Rebecca Martinez from the Bighorn Radio Network in Cody about what makes Heart Mountain so special.
You know, Heart Mountain is this really unique geological formation that has attracted the eye of people for like 12,000 years worth of human habitation in this area. The way it rests out there on the Bighorn Basin, but also because of its proximity to Yellowstone, it points the way to the Shoshone River and how to get up into Yellowstone. So it has been a landmark that has attracted people's eyes and their hearts for a long time.
So what will students do during this field course?
It's going to be great. We will benefit from two instructors, Mary Humstone, who does is a historic preservationist, and myself. And we will both benefit from the Heart Mountain Interpretive Center and an American Studies project called Heart Mountain Barracks Revisited, so that students will be able to go through the Heart Mountain Interpretive Center to benefit from the Heart Mountain Foundation's annual pilgrimage. So we'll have a chance to meet with actual internees who have who come back for this annual pilgrimage. We will travel to the north, the south, the east, and the west, and look from a distance at the role that Heart Mountain plays on the land. We will hike, we will draw, we will be reading extensively in an interdisciplinary study of both sacred lands issues and the history of the mountain. And we will, through this, have a combination of both research and pragmatic experience with the mountain.
You know, you'd mentioned that Heart Mountain has a long period of history as far as its significance to people of different cultures and at different times. Can you tell me about what makes Heart Mountain significant to different groups of people.
Yeah, this is one of the reasons it's a great, we call the course that Heart Mountain is an icon of American landscapes, and it absolutely is. So we've got roughly 12,000 years worth of indigenous presence in the region, and that trails led to and past Heart Mountain. So we have an indigenous layer on this mountain that's ancient and deep. The Crow were in the area for about the last 500 years, so that by the time of the Fort Laramie Treaty of 1851, they were given this whole region here as part of their territory, and they have a unique relationship to the mountain that we'll talk about in a bit. And then during World War II, 1942 to 1945, Japanese-American internees lived in the fourth largest city in Wyoming at a relocation camp right there at the shoulder of the mountain. And so much of their art and much of their recollections about their time there has to do with the power of that mountain as the landmark of their experience. And then after the war, homesteaders were given both access to those barracks and to the land around Heart Mountain through a couple of lotteries. And so then the settling, the homesteaders built a whole new layer of this, where Heart Mountain stands uniquely as a model of home. If you even just look at the number of signs around Cody and Powell that use Heart Mountain as their icon, it's clear that Heart Mountain has a power in our hearts to let us know when we're home.
You're leading this course with another instructor, historic preservation specialist Mary Humstone. I understand she'll be covering a lot of the history with students, but your background is the history of religions. What's the religious and cultural significance of Heart Mountain?
Mountains have played a role on landscapes as a source of sacred power across time and cultures. And in this case, if we look specifically, for instance, with the Crow notion, they saw Heart Mountain's austere presence as the kind of place where if a person fasted and made offerings, they might actually have access to the power of the Creator's capacity to see supernatural power at work in the world, so that they would seek out at Heart Mountain the gift from the Creator that allows them to see supernatural power in the world. One of their ancestors, Foretop, this is a very American story. He was an orphan who sought out power from the mountain, and the mountain granted him great power that was evidenced in his authority and skill as a leader. And so they, over time, grew to call the mountain Foretop's father, because clearly the mountain had adopted this orphan and had given him the kind of power that made a person effective and a good community member. So that's a great story to open up. If you don't know that, and then you look at Heart Mountain after you've heard that story, the fact that it was a mountain that adopted a human and gave them the skills they needed to lead their community, that's a good story for our time.
Why is a field course the best way to tackle these subjects, and what do you want these students to take away from it?
As an icon of an American landscape, Heart Mountain will bring students directly into, one, just the good old experience of moving across some of Wyoming and learning Wyoming through your feet. That's important. And two, then there are elements of American history that are contentious, that ask us questions of conscience, such as the relocation of Japanese Americans and the internment there and the removal of indigenous people. And so students will get to look at the heart of being Americans, and that heart contains with it some of these contentious and contested sites on the American landscape. So I think that's an important experience. The capacity to tap into the Heart Mountain Foundation pilgrimage, as well as the Heart Mountain Reconnection Project, that's a great opportunity to meet people who share such deep connections to this mountain. And my opportunity to work with Mary Humstone and a group of students out on the land, I'm a pretty pragmatic academic, So if I can think and move with people in real life experiences, that's where I want to do my teaching.
Mary Keller is an historian of religions and a lecturer at UW. She and historic preservation specialist Mary Humstone will lead UW's first field course at Heart Mountain. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks so much for having us.
When we come back, we'll look at the growing trend of oil being transported by railroad, and we'll travel to Rock Springs, where former mining operations have caused town infrastructure to collapse. This is Open Spaces.
Welcome back to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Willow Belden.
And I'm Bob Beck. A facility is slated to be built in the town of Fort Laramie that would load oil onto rail cars. Assuming the project gets the necessary permits from the Wyoming Department of Environmental Quality, it is expected to be completed by the end of the year. Transporting oil by train is becoming increasingly popular, and experts say this facility and others like it will help the energy industry thrive. But local residents fear that a new industrial site could bring problems to their community. Wyoming Public Radio's Willow Belden reports.
The oil loading station would take crude oil from existing pipelines and load it onto rail cars to be shipped to the east and west coasts. It would have the capacity to load 23 million barrels of oil per year, which is about half the amount produced in Wyoming. Tad True is responsible for construction of the oil loading station. He says Wyoming needs facilities like this because more oil is being produced than the pipelines and nearby refineries can handle.
Right now, there's just simply a lack of takeaway capacity on pipelines, and so the only alternative is to turn to rail.
While it's more expensive, train transport provides important flexibility.
Pipelines go from point A to point B, and that's the only place they will ever go. Whereas a railroad, you can get onto a railroad and you can start point A, go to point Z, M, N, O, P, and A.
True says that means they'll be able to ship crude to places that don't have pipelines, like points on the East Coast. Those areas have traditionally relied on foreign oil, and True says enabling them to buy domestic oil is one step the U.S. can take toward energy independence. Rob Herlis is deputy director of the School of Energy Resources at the University of Wyoming. He adds that producers can sell the oil for more money on the coasts because people there are used to paying high international prices. And the buyers benefit, too.
All of a sudden, you know, somebody from North Dakota says, gee whiz, you're paying $105 a barrel for that. We'll sell it to you for $103 or $100 or whatever.
New data from the U.S. Energy Information Administration shows that about 700,000 barrels of crude are transported by rail each day, which is nearly one-tenth of what the U.S. produces. And Herlis says he expects the numbers to keep rising, which is why new oil loading stations are so popular. Officials with Goshen County say the facility will be a good thing for the area because it will bring dozens of jobs and boost property tax revenue. But for some residents, the negatives outweigh the positives. Tom Wilson is one of them. He stands by the barbed wire fence that separates his ranch from the site where the oil loading station is going in. Heavy equipment chugs through the site, building up a base to put in several sets of railroad tracks.
The train tracks are about 80 yards from our house.
Wilson and his wife have lived here since the 1960s. Their front porch used to look out onto cornfields. Now their view is of a construction site, and once the facility is built, Wilson says all they'll see is train cars. In addition to the visual aspect, he's worried about noise, dust, and emissions from the facility.
This has been our home. We intended to be here, and we had no idea that we were going to be invaded by an industrial complex.
Wilson says he estimates that his property value could decrease as much as 25% because of the new facility. He's not alone in his concerns. Just outside the town of Fort Laramie is a National Historic Site. This was a former trading post along the Oregon Trail and later a military camp. Tens of thousands of tourists visit each year. Mitzi Frank is the superintendent of the site.
When visitors come to Old Fort Laramie, one of the things they comment the most about, the place is that when they come here, they feel like they've stepped back into time. They get a sense of not only Wyoming's history, but our nation's history. And so one of the things that impedes that sense of place is any kind of development that takes place around the fort.
Other residents worry about potential fires, citing the recent oil train disaster in Canada, and many believe emissions from the facility could pollute the air. Company officials say they're taking all the necessary safety precautions and that their technology will destroy 98% of harmful emissions. But the Department of Environmental Quality has no plans to monitor air quality in the area, either before or after the facility is completed.
There has been a lack of regulatory oversight, as rail has become a large means of moving crude oil.
That's Anthony Swift, an attorney with the Natural Resources Defense Council. He says there needs to be a thorough analysis of how shipping oil by rail affects local communities in the U.S. and possibly new regulations to protect those communities. But he adds that there are pros and cons to both rail and pipeline transport.
When it comes to spills, rail lines spill more frequently per barrel, but when pipeline spills happen, they tend to be larger and therefore pipelines actually spill more crude per barrel.
Overall, though, from an environmental point of view, Swift says the question people should be asking is not how to transport more oil, but how to use less oil. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Willow Belden.
More than 50 years ago, residents of Rock Springs were shocked to learn that many of their houses, schools, and churches were in danger. The coal mines built underneath the town were beginning to collapse due to neglect and some environmental factors. It's called subsidence, and it's happening in older mining towns all over the West. Amanda LeClaire has more on how the city has been dealing with the problem, both then and now.
Where that park is, across, there were two or three houses in there that were, you might say, totally demolished and moved out.
I'm driving down a street in Rock Springs with Wayne Johnson, a retired engineer and a man who's lived his entire life right here in southwest Wyoming. Back in the 70s and 80s, Johnson ran a company that created the first official report about a problem which shook up local residents and changed the way mining communities all over the world thought about infrastructure.
Years ago, when they started having problems, you could actually look down this street and you could see it like waves would go up and down, and the high spots would be over coal that was left in the mine, and the low spots would be where it subsided.
The problem began in earnest only a few decades after coal mining initially began in Rock Springs. Subsidence was first reported in 1909 at the state hospital. The damage was minor, but enough to crack the hospital's water main and cause excavators to discover that the ground underneath the hospital was sinking, and fast. Over the next few decades, sinkholes opened up in the area that's now the historic district of the city, one in front of the old Opera House, another at the Southside Catholic Church. But the height of the subsidence problem really began in the late 60s, more than 40 years after the last coal mine closed in Rock Springs. In January of 1968, residents living on D Street woke to find large crevices underneath their homes had opened up overnight. The problem escalated so quickly that within months, some residents were forced to abandon their homes for good. Johnson pulls out a few archival photographs of the area.
This guy's name was John Marushak, and his house was right in here. Now, he kind of maintained his house, but he was in the basement every day, and you can see part of a jack where he would jack it up a little bit every day to keep his house level.
State efforts to deal with subsidence began in the mid-70s. That's when Janelle Hunter came in. She's currently the local liaison for the Abandoned Mine Land Division, also known as the AML.
We started having homes falling in, streets falling in, utilities failing. Bureau of Mines came in and started doing a test program where they injected a slurry, a sand slurry, into the mine workings. And that was done in the downtown Rock Springs area and several other outlying residential areas.
That initial testing with sand slurry wasn't exactly successful. Hunter says that due to the way coal was mined in Rock Springs, where shafts were built on an angle instead of horizontally, the water in the slurry separated and did not support the ground above the empty mine shaft. According to Hunter, a number of different techniques were tried over the years, but by far the most successful has been the use of a cement-based slurry called grout. Since then, no major problems have been reported near those areas first affected by subsidence. But as more than 60% of Rock Springs is believed to be undermined, the process of filling in all the potential problem areas is ongoing. Hunter says nowadays, state government is more proactive. Instead of waiting for a sinkhole to open up or a building to show signs of damage, the AML regularly fills empty shafts staffs with grout before subsidence begins. Rob Gerard is the project manager for the engineering firm JFC. He and his crew are busy this summer, filling in an area on the west end of the city.
Yeah, this is a crucial area in Rock Springs. We are supporting the water tanks and also the water lines that feed the tanks. And these tanks here feed a majority of the town water. Well, we've encountered some large voids under it, and we're just trying to be proactive and to support these tanks and to make sure that nothing happens to them.
Crews are also filling in vital areas near Interstate 80 and other major thoroughfares. Hunter says that while the problem of subsidence is no longer an immediate concern for most residents, the AML expects to continue working in Rock Springs for years to come. On a positive note, she says that's led to significant progress in mining technology.
Most of the drilling and grouting technology that is utilized worldwide, a great portion of it has been developed here in Rock Springs as we've had to go through these residential areas. It's a difficult thing to set up a drill rig in the middle of a residential area and drill a hole and pump grout into it when the person is living right there next to the drill rig. So we've developed a lot of very successful techniques to make it as pleasant as possible, if I can use that word.
Hunter adds that while most of the abandoned mines in the area have been documented, new sinkholes occasionally surprise the agency. She asks local residents to contact authorities right away if they find one on their property. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Amanda LeClaire in Rock Springs.
Julianne Couch is the author of Traveling the Power Line, a book about the many energy sources we tap into for our power needs, from oil and gas to wind to solar and uranium. Couch teaches at the University of Wyoming remotely and has also written Jukeboxes and Jackalopes, A Wyoming Bar Journey, and Waking Up Western, collected essays. She now lives in Iowa, but stopped by the studio to talk to Wyoming Public Radio's Irina Joroff about her new book.
I was trying to do something that most people don't do, but I think most consumers out there need, and that is someone to help them unravel all of the various advocacy messages that are out there arguing for and against just about everything related to energy.
Mm-hmm. And you start off each chapter with a very diary-esque breakdown of the weather, brief synopsis of what's going on in your own household. Why did you decide to personalize the narrative in that way?
Well, a few reasons. First of all, I was thinking of myself in kind of grand terms as writing an exploration narrative. Mm-hmm. And so I thought I'd make it kind of a diary of my home base as I forayed out into the world. But also, I really wanted to make the point that Wyoming is so steeped in the conversation about energy that it was a revelation to me to get out into the world and realize that wasn't the case everywhere. But here it affects everything about the way we live in our state. And it's so ever present that you almost don't notice the conversation after a while.
Yeah, and so the book is very localized. I mean, as someone who also lives in Laramie, mm-hmm. it was very much a Wyoming Laramie book.
Mm-hmm.
How did that change how you approached other areas of the country?
It allowed me to go into each conversation with some degree of feeling like I had – feeling confident a little bit about my knowledge base, but able to go to someone like in Maine, for example, where they have coastal, you know, wave power and say – I don't live on the ocean. I can tell you some things about natural gas and wind, but, you know, I know basically about power consumption and production, but I know nothing about this. The differences between what we do here with public lands and what they do in places like that with private lands. At least it gave me a starting point against which to compare how things were happening in other places around the country.
You bring up Maine. The book is very much a journey. You're always
yes.
kind of on the move. So you're traveling to power plants, production sites, research facilities. What did you want to convey with all the movement that the book has?
I wanted to convey that getting the basic knowledge I think that we all need as consumers is not easy. You can turn on your television and radio and hear an advocacy an announcement for oil and gas or so on and so forth. And it's very easy just to say, okay, well, you know, given what I already believe about the world in certain ways, I'm going to select this message as being accurate or that message as being accurate. To understand what's, you know, the basics of our industrial economy, though, and to develop informed opinions based on personal firsthand knowledge takes work. I might be wrong, but I'm not sure anybody else has done what I've done,
mm-hmm.
you know, gone to places at 9 different types of places. But I really felt I had to do that to understand and to think more carefully about what I'm hearing. You know, the book is really as much about how power is made as understanding what to think about how power is made.
It's a very even-keeled book, but you do give hints of sort of your own perspective and how power should be used and perhaps approached. So what did researching the book do for you? I mean, what did it change your mind about anything? Or
unfortunately, it complicated things even more for me than it already was. I became an even greater believer in the importance of conservation of energy, for one thing. I became heartened in the last few years since I've written the book to read about how our nation's consumption has dropped several percentage points, which is good. I became convinced of the possibility of renewals really becoming a player in the national portfolio. What started off just seeming like, oh yeah, we'll stick a wind farm over there and it's just going to make a, you know, make people feel good, that states are really, really ramping up their renewable energy regulations into, you know, over the next 10 years, and it's really going to become important. You know, I've gone back and forth about nuclear. You know, it's funny, they were the most, that was the easiest place for me to get into as a journalist.
That's not expected.
No, it was not expected. And I think the reason is they were most interested in having the chance to have their message get out there.
And so it was a PR effort on their.
Yeah, yeah. Because, well, and then the hardest place to get into was the solar plant.
So why do you think that is?
They were very reluctant and concerned about what I was going to say. They wanted to know what I was going to say, what my views were about solar power before they let me in the door. And many places would not let me in at all. I finally found somebody who would give me a tour in Boulder City, Nevada, for which I was grateful. But it was just unexpected and surprising how I was greeted and, you know, at each of those places and how much time people spent with me. The natural gas people spent a whole day with me. Other people were like, walk around. Nobody's really here to help you, but there's a plaque on the wall you can read. And so you really had to dig. And so what I've done is something that I don't think the average person would do. So making it engaging and personal, to a long answer to a short question, is my way to make people relate to what I had to go through to do this, and hopefully save them some gas miles for the drive, but get the information.
Was there anything you ended up leaving out of the book just because you couldn't get access or for any other reason?
No. I got to all the places that create power that I wanted to get. One thing I really wanted to be able to do but just could never figure it out because I don't think it exists, I wanted to sit in a control room like this and see how the decisions are made to send power to different places as the need over just any day ebbs and flows. There really isn't a room like that, but I wanted there to be. We have a power grid that's, you know, east and west, and there are places where someone's saying, oh, she turned on an air conditioner in Philly, you know, spin another windmill. There really are places like that.
Yeah.
But I just couldn't find a way to have that experience, but I think that would be pretty cool.
So maybe your next book should be about distribution of power.
Yeah, that'll be it. Yeah, sure.
Julianne Couch is the author of Traveling the Power Line, out from University of Nebraska Press. Thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you so much for the opportunity. I appreciate it.
When we come back, we'll visit a chocolatier in Meteetse, and we'll hear about a special event that's happening at the Rodeo in Sheridan this weekend. This is Open Spaces.
Welcome to Open Spaces. I'm Willow Belden.
And I'm Bob Beck. The Sheridan Wyo Rodeo will host the return of some special guests this year. The Miss Indian American pageant was held during the rodeo from 1953 until 1984, and several past winners will reunite this weekend. Wyoming Public Radio's Irina Zhorov has the story.
There is a town out west where the eye can stretch over the plains, from mesa to mountain, where the heart warms in the sunshine of friends and the townspeople can see buffalo from their own backyards. Such a place is Sheridan, Wyoming.
In the 1950s, historian Gregory Nickerson says Sheridan was not unlike the Jim Crow era South, but with Native Americans.
There were these signs in Sheridan's downtown businesses that said things like, no Indians or dogs allowed, and the folks from the Crow Indian Reservation would come down and try and shop at these businesses and be forced out of the business.
A group of civic-minded residents looked for ways to change things in town. They came up with the Miss Indian America pageant. They documented the birth of the pageant on a record cut in 1966.
Miss Indian America, intercourse be.
Nickerson says from the beginning the focus was slightly different than, say, in the Miss America pageant, on which it was based.
It was more about selecting someone who would have the ability to be a good public relations person. There wasn't like a swimsuit section of the Miss Indian America pageant.
Miss Indian America must first of all be dedicated to the cultural well-being of her tribe. She must have a comprehensive knowledge of her people, be dedicated to the advancement.
She must have the appearance, personality, and poise to represent her people in the white community.
The winner spent 1 year in Sheridan and traveled around the U.S. and sometimes Europe speaking about their respective tribes and Native American issues. Wahela Lujan is Miss Indian America 1966. She says she was an extremely shy girl then. Here she is speaking after being crowned.
I am so happy. I don't know what to say. This is such a great honor to be elected Miss Indian America. I will try to be worthy of the title.
On the record, she addresses a group at a ladies' luncheon, part of her PR duties in Sheridan.
The most important thing in my life is the preservation of our ancient Pueblo and the Rio Pueblo de Taos, the river that flows through our Pueblo from the Blue Lake.
Lujan recently recalled that that was the issue she pushed during her tenure, an issue that eventually got resolved.
After 60-some-odd years of our people just quietly not giving up, had our Blue Lake land returned to us. And I think that was one of my greatest, the best way I could help my people.
Still, Nickerson says despite the pageant's good intentions, there were issues with it too. For instance, there was resistance by some participants to an all-white panel of judges.
It's kind of like they were saying, we know what the definition of a good, upstanding Indian woman, and we should be the ones to choose that.
But Miss Indian America from 1960, Vivian Arviso, says it was a sign of the times.
This is the 50s. This is the start of this kind of thing.
Another sign of the times? Arviso's year of service as Miss Indian America included a stint answering tourists' questions at the Indian Village in Disneyland.
The tourists really needed to be able to ask questions, not just watch Indians dance or do sand paintings or do a textile weaving.
Arviso says she tried to answer those questions and address stereotypes as best she could.
I was unknowingly called an activist, and I think that was before the term came up in later decades, but I tried to share what I knew.
Both Lujan and Arviso say the experience built confidence in them and helped them succeed in future endeavors. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Irina Zhorov.
Rancher and former saddle bronc rider Tim Kellogg of Meteetse began selling homemade chocolates on weekends to bankroll his rodeo passion in 2004. Known by many as the Meteetse Chocolatier, Kellogg now runs a shop on the little town's main street 7 days a week, drawing locals and tourists back again and again for his rich and creative flavor pairings. Rebecca Martinez interviewed him and produced this piece.
There's quite a bit.
My name is Tim Kellogg. I'm also known as the Meteetse Chocolatier. I founded and run Meteetse Chocolatier here in Meteetse, Wyoming, and we make artisan chocolates.
We have a hibiscus, which is an edible flower, and it has almost kind of like a mild cranberry taste to it.
Now that we're established, I can kind of focus more on quality, not quantity, and kind of play with some exotic flavors or unusual pairings. And thankfully, most of those have sold very well. The big one was conifer. I make my own pine needle extract and make a chocolate out of that. And when I did it, I thought it tasted really good. It was really cool, and I was very excited. I'm like, no one is ever going to buy this. And it sells so well. I mean, it's almost kind of like a mythological characteristic to it now because people are all talking about it. But my favorite chocolate that did not work was I blended organic oregano with the dark chocolate. and it was just beautiful. And it tasted so good, and I couldn't even give them away. And I was so upset. I took that one personally. But I think, you know, our motto here is fear no chocolate. So I'm trying to broaden other people's horizons as I broaden my own. And, you know, there's a lot of things that can blend well with chocolate beyond the basics, like champagne or Bailey's or mocha or mint. And so it's kind of nice to bring in these different pairs. And sometimes they work, sometimes they don't. Don't cringe. Yeah. I wouldn't make it if it didn't taste well. No, it's not hot. It's not hot at all. The chipotle and the jalapeno are hot, but it's peppercorn. It's cracked peppercorns. I used to be a saddle bronc rider, and I had broken the tree of my saddle and needed to buy a new one, and they're quite expensive. And my mom suggested that I make a bunch of truffles and brownies and sell them in Cody during the Cody Stampede at the Art in the Park. And those were things that I had done in tradition with my grandmother. Oh, my grandmother was a phenomenal baker, and she used to make all sorts of chocolates, just amazing, amazing stuff. And after she passed on, I would kind of keep some of that tradition alive and make some things at Christmas or other times of the year just to kind of keep her memory going. And that's kind of how that got started. I really wasn't too thrilled to be making chocolate in the beginning because, you know, I was working full-time on the ranch and rodeoing, and those were my two main focuses. And spending time in the hot kitchen in the middle of summer was not a pleasant experience. The business really started to grow very rapidly once I opened the storefront. I kind of didn't have a choice. I ran out of home use permits, and so I had to rent someplace where I could have a certified kitchen. And so when I first opened, you know, we were only open on Saturdays, and all the money I made would go to pay for ingredients for the next weekend. Unfortunately, or fortunately, depending on who's looking, about a year after the business started, I had a pretty bad wreck at a rodeo in Colorado and broke my ankle, dislocated my shoulder, and a few other little things. And I was like, well, I was never going to make it to the NFR, so I might as well stick to the ranch and the store. And there was also a few women in town here who threatened me that if I went back to rodeo, they would break my other leg. So because they didn't want me to give up the store. And pretty quickly after that first December, we went to Saturdays and Sundays. And then that spring, it was Friday, Saturday, Sunday. And then that summer, it was Thursday through Sunday. And then as my confidence grew and my ability grew and the customer base grew, as people found out about me, you know, I was able to move on to Main Street. And I kept growing slowly. And I think that was part dumb luck, but that was the whole basis for my success.
The IPA. Two? Just one.
When I first started, I honestly did not know what I was doing. I had my set way of making the chocolates because that's how I knew how to make them. And so after a few years, I really kind of hit a wall. And I wanted to grow, but there's only so much you can do with the Food Network and with Google. I kind of got to like in a rut where everything was kind of the same thing, only different, if that makes sense. And at that point, I had no formal culinary experience. And I did not want to go to culinary school because I didn't want to take 2 years off. And I don't need to know how to debone a fish. And I just wanted to make chocolates and desserts. And I found this chocolate-based culinary school in London. It's called the Chocolate Academy that caters to working professional chocolatiers. And so you go and you take a course that's 2 or 3 days long or however many days. Like there's one class on petit fours or on plated desserts or on, you know, ganaches or this or that. And, you know, and I got in, and it was such a wonderful environment. And it was definitely not a Gordon Ramsay kitchen, because if someone made a mistake, they'd be like, oh, look, you know, this happens to every chocolatier. This is how you prevent it, or this is how you fix it. And so it was a really great environment.
Thank you.
And I've been working side by side with a lot of these chocolatiers for years now, and I've kind of gained a confidence, and it's really neat to see the chocolates in my case now compared to what they were years ago. And that's how I base my success, is the quality of my product. And to see the things that in the case now, I never in my life would have dreamed of 8 years ago.
Kellogg celebrates his 9th year as the Meatitzy Chocolatier this month. For more information about his business, you can find it at meatitzychocolatier.com.
That's our program for this week. If you want to hear it again, you can find it online at wyomingpublicmedia.org.
You can also send us ideas for future programs on that site and sign up for our podcast. Anna Rader is our web editor. For those of you on Facebook, we invite you to become a fan of Wyoming Public Radio News by clicking on the like button. And for news updates and other information, you can follow us on Twitter. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.